Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is May 24th, 2012. Beautiful day. Should really be outside. That's what they say when it's nice like this. Anyway, today on the show, we are going to be continuing our series on logic and logical fallacies. You might remember when we first kicked this off about 2 months ago. It was episode 130. My guests were Richard Grove and Tony Myers, both from TragedyandHope.com. And we introduced the topic and discussed some of the reasons why we found this pursuit to be so important. It focused around empowerment and self-defense. So today on the show, we continue and we're going to put down a foundation looking at the basics of logic as a science, as a discipline. Helping me with that, in fact, doing the majority of the heavy lifting, is going to be the oldest friend of the show, Wes Bertrand. Wes was the first person that I ever reached out to with the intention of working together. I said, how can we do stuff together? After I had heard his Complete Liberty podcast, and he and I actually wound up doing a series on education over 3 years ago. It's a Complete Liberty podcast. I think it starts around episode 48. So this was back at the end of 2008 and the beginning of 2009. Remember those days? And off and on, we've been working together ever since, even though it has certainly been a while since you've heard him on this show. Today, we're going to be looking at the logic basics through the lens of objectivism, specifically the work of Leonard Peikoff, even more specifically, a couple of his books. First one is Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, and the other is Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Objectivism is a very clear and clean way of understanding what would otherwise be some very abstruse concepts. Objectivism, as we talked about in the American Way Expanded series, really cleaned up a big philosophical mess that had been going on for a couple of centuries in certain places, and because of the propagation of school systems like the one that started in Prussia, were really catching on around the world and still have their fangs and claws sunk pretty deep into the United States today. And we also cover something else in this show that I think is especially important. It's one thing to understand this stuff. It's a very different thing to be able to communicate it to others in a way that is not only effective, but meaningful and rewarding for the communicator. That's going to be you. So Wes has put a lot of work into this over the course of the last year, learning ways to communicate not only more effectively, but more placidly, productively. And so that's something else that we are going to incorporate into this show, attitudes and values. So I hope this is helpful. I hope this is educational. I look forward to your feedback. Thank you very much for listening. Take care. My guest today is Wes Bertrand, old friend of the show. Wes, how you doing?
Doing well, yes. An old friend. Back in my day, we used to do podcasts together.
My audience hasn't heard from you in, geez, I think the last time we actually sat down and did a show was sometime in 2010. Definitely been a while since it's just been me and you chatting here, so it's good to have you back. And
thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Do you want to take a few minutes just to let School Sucks folks know what you've been up to?
Well, you know, last year I started a series on a book that I read called Unconditional Parenting by Alfie Cohn.
Yeah.
And in that book, Cohn kind of articulates what the real problem is with our culture in terms of how we look at dealing with little people, shall we say.
Sure.
There's a big disconnect that goes on there in terms of meeting their needs for respect and choice and autonomy. And this basically creates a lot of the statist madness that we see in our culture and a lot of the conformity, the things that you talk about on your show and the educational system, so-called. So I've been focusing a lot on parenting lately, but more recently I started a series, and this is Complete Liberty Podcast, by the way.
Yep.
A series on religion. So you're going to be part of a roundtable in the coming weeks on that. It's probably going to be about half a dozen roundtables, maybe.
Mm.
So,
yep. We just did a discussion, a little discussion about religion on my live show, and we had quite a group there. I was raised Roman Catholic. Mandrick, who was co-hosting, was Greek Orthodox, and Jason Osborne, was a fundamentalist Christian. So we had it covered. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. And you also went on this cruise last year, right? This Liberty cruise?
We did. We did the Liberty cruise, Liberty getaway cruise to Bermuda. And man, I survived the gale force winds there. We're talking, I think it was gale force 7, which Whoa. Gets up to 50 miles an hour or 50 knots. Yeah, the way the ship was coming into the port there, it was getting blown into these rocks that are by the place where they're supposed to dock. So he had to turn on the thrusters on the bow of the ship to make sure that we didn't have a catastrophe. But once we got docked, man, the winds were just so blustery. But we managed to get out in the ocean, did some splashing around, and the temperature was like in the 70s, and the water temperature was in the high 70s. So it was great. Had a good time.
Excellent. And I wanted to go, but I will announce this on the show right now. It looks like this year I'm going to be going in your place.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Is this the one in the Florida Keys?
This is the one in the Florida Keys. I think it's near Hollywood. I want to say Hollywood, Florida, or some place in Florida named after some location in outer space as places. And I want to say Hollywood, Florida, but it could be something like Mars. That's wrong.
Can find us an island there, a deserted island that we can plant our flag on.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We're going to need flags.
Yeah, that's yeah. So I think it's going to be Stefan, you, and Mark Edge, I believe, yeah. If he's going to be able to make it.
Yeah. So definitely looking forward to that, and I will provide more details as they become available. But
absolutely.
What we're going to do today... it was quite a while ago, maybe 5 weeks ago at this point, I introduced this logical fallacy series that I wanted to do over time, and I brought in a couple of guys from Tragedy and Hope to do just a basic orientation with why is this valuable, the empowerment aspect, the self-defense aspect of being able to detect the kind of BS that's being thrown, especially at young people who are large targets for this from all different directions in society. And what we're going to do today is a little bit of a primer on the basics and the questions that I wanted to get answered, or the question specifically is, what should a person's foundational knowledge be of logic as a discipline, as a science, to put themselves in the proper position to be able to detect fallacies successfully, but also to be able to explain them in a persuasive way to other people. So the guys I had on before talked about, we were using the trivium as kind of a shorthand for having background knowledge on a subject. Like, you could have logically flawless arguments and no background knowledge and you won't be particularly effective. But also your communication is very important, your rhetoric. And a lot of that comes from, you know, the attitudes and the values and the approach that you bring to communicating with other people with the goal of persuasion. So we want to start dealing specifically with logic and just talking about, like, what's the foundation a person should – where should somebody start if they want a better understanding of this?
Yeah, yeah. And when you mention logic, we are now in the realm of philosophy, right?
Yes.
And in particular, you know, I draw a lot of my philosophical insights from the novelist philosopher Ayn Rand. If you listen to my show, I kind of sprinkle the objectivist ideas throughout, because the structure of objectivism is really something that helped me see through all of the code of the matrix, or see the code of the matrix, to wake up to the fact that our minds really haven't been honored in the way that they can be. And our culture is really at odds epistemologically with our method of functioning as conceptual beings. So Rand was... the philosopher that I saw, all the philosophers that I looked at, that delineated philosophy in a really comprehensive fashion. So she said that it's really five branches. We have metaphysics, we have epistemology, we have ethics, we have politics, and we have aesthetics, the nature of art or beauty, right? So when we talk about logic, we're talking about epistemology, because metaphysics is the nature of reality. That which exists. What is the nature of these things? And there's three metaphysical laws, essentially: the law of identity, the law of causality, and the law of non-contradiction, or it could be called the law of contradiction, according to Aristotle. I mean, this goes way back to the ancient Greeks. So when we look at those fundamental laws, we're asking questions: how do we know what we know? how do we know what truth is? What is truth and what is a contradiction, essentially? How can we decipher what contradictions are? And I think using logic in this way is somewhat foreign to most intellectuals in our culture. I mean, I had a couple philosophy classes. One of them was logic. And surprisingly, we didn't even talk about the logic that Rand talked about. And from her frame of reference, logic was about understanding reality in a non-contradictory way. So she called it the art of non-contradictory identification, because existence is identity. Things exist in reality. Things or existence have properties, attributes, characteristics, which we conceptualize into concepts, into abstractions, so we can make sense of things in a way that other animals simply can't. They're just perceptual. They don't integrate percepts into concepts like we do. So once we get to this conceptual creature called Homo sapiens, then the question is, how can we integrate reality in a non-contradictory way? How can we see things for what they are, rather than a jumbled mess of things, you know, because philosophy is pretty much a jumbled mess of things in modern terms, you know?
Yeah.
And Rand, you know, there's a thing called Rand's razor, where she just cuts through all of the nonsense and asks the person, so what are your primaries? What are your fundamental premises? And in the novel, she has Hugh Axton, I think the character said, check your premises. And this is the thing that is really rarely encouraged for children in school and education, right? Check your premises. Let's examine the concepts by which we're behaving in certain ways. So logic, being the art of non-contradictory identification, is a way to understand concepts as they're related to reality. So this is kind of a foreign thing too, because we have a lot of concepts in our culture that don't relate to reality, that are disconnected completely, that they're in the land of the arbitrary. And in this book, Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, which is written by Leonard Peikoff, he notes that arbitrary assumptions like God or an afterlife or things that have no reference in reality, that aren't based on any knowledge that we have, no scientific understanding, but are just that arbitrary, really don't classify as any sort of knowledge, and they're beyond the realm of truth or false claims, you know? So yeah. You have two choices at that point. You can either dismiss it as being arbitrary, or you can help the person along to understand just exactly why it is arbitrary.
Yeah. And I think, too, that what's important to point out before we get into the realm of religion and politics is that it seems that people have a real natural propensity to want to remove these contradictions. So when they encounter new ideas, that seems to be one of the reasons why people are very dismissive often in an emotional way of anything that creates friction with the belief system with which they're comfortable. So
yes,
they want to, and this is the idea, I guess, of cognitive dissonance, where new information is presented, and that's why we can see that information just so quickly rejected. But also, I think that one of the things that we've discussed several times in the last couple of days and into the distant past is that logic isn't even a factor in most of the discourse in these areas, because people are trapped into this emotional thinking.
Mm-hmm. Emotional thinking driving the beliefs that they have, and a belief may or may not be based on the facts of reality.
Right.
So when we have a term like belief, that is a word symbolizing a concept, designating the distinguishing characteristics of a mental process by which we've integrated something. It may or may not be based on the facts of reality, right? Mm-hmm. So there are a multiplicity of beliefs in people's minds today that aren't based on reality. And that's the thrust of what objectivism is from an epistemological point of view, is looking at things in reality and in your own mind, which is part of reality. Like, we can't escape reality. There are these axioms, these axiomatic concepts, consciousness, identity, and existence. These are presupposed in everything we say and do. Now, modern philosophy is doing a pretty good job of trying to deny these things and sort of circumvent or refute them in a sense. Like, we can't know anything for certain. There are no absolutes.
It takes people away from the idea that things can be known, that there is such a thing as fact or truth, and leaves everything that is open to interpretation and has this kind of flexibility. And we wind up with expressions like everybody's entitled to their opinion, right? As if all opinions are equal because everybody having one is a person, you know? So yes. It totally takes out like what is behind that opinion, what that opinion grew from as far as a knowledge base. And it just says, well, you know, we disagree, but we our opinions are equal, so let's just call it a draw, you know?
Yeah, everyone is entitled to their own opinion, right? That's another catchphrase. It may be true for you, but it's not true for me.
Mm, sure, yeah.
That's another example, which indicates that somehow objective knowledge is impossible. And I think when we talk about logic, it's inextricably tied to objectivity, because objectivity is the process by which we use the method or process of logic to discern truth and to determine what's true, what's valid, what's contradictory or not. Mm-hmm. So objectivity is really the relating of a human consciousness to reality, to things in reality, and identifying the distinguishing characteristics of certain things and calling them names, right? So a famous example with Helen Keller, she wasn't able to see or hear, right? And so she didn't have any words to describe her experiences in a sense that she was living in a perceptual realm. Imagine going through life without any concepts in your mind, without any words, without any language. And there's cases of this throughout history. There was a wild boy of Averon, I think it was, in Europe at one time, raised by wolves or something like that. But if we don't have words to communicate what we're identifying in reality, it really reduces our level of thinking and our ability to abstract. So Rand focuses on this as this process by which a conceptual consciousness relates to things in reality in a non-contradictory way. So it goes back once again to Aristotle, who said, A is A is not non-A. A thing can't be itself and not itself in the same way, in the same respect, because that would be a contradiction.
Right.
So in other words, there aren't any contradictions in objective reality. And so the task for humans, for our minds, no matter what our age is to understand reality in a non-contradictory way. So we can devise ways of understanding things that accord with reality rather than oppose it, and accord with other knowledge that we have. Because another aspect of the objectivity process is knowing that knowledge is hierarchical and knowledge is contextual. So the hierarchy of knowledge is kind of a fundamental understanding of the fact that we first must know like a chair and a table before we can grasp the concept furniture,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are derivative concepts that are based on just facts that we build upon and develop knowledge. So Peikoff in here mentions that rather than seeing knowledge as all these sort of separated bungalows on a flat plane, you know, which is kind of how it's presented to people in school and stuff. It's like everything is disconnected. Nothing is related to anything else. And everything is kind of out of context.
Yeah.
This is seeing it as hierarchical in the sense that knowledge is like skyscrapers. We're building upon knowledge, like the famous phrase, if I've accomplished anything, it's only by virtue of standing on the shoulders of giants, right? Who is where was that quote from?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank.
Students, where's that quote from? We could Google it. But so the hierarchy is one thing, and then the context is another thing. So context meaning that everything is related to everything else. And this is the thing that is continually dropped in education and in philosophy, that somehow we can't understand things that are related to other things, right, in a non-contradictory way. So we find some discipline of science seeming to contradict another discipline of science. I'm thinking like some of the assertions in quantum physics, quantum mechanics and stuff, which seems to contradict things in the macro world that we know of.
Sure, you know? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And of course, all the supernatural concepts directly contradict the things that we know in reality, the things that we perceive on a daily basis. But yet these are incorporated into our belief system, and there's not a lot of ferreting out of where the reality is and where the truth is versus where the falsehood is. And a lot of these claims are made in a dogmatic fashion. You know, they're asserted in a way that makes it seem as if they're true, mm-hmm. but in fact they're not. So it's the quest to try to look at what a person is saying, the propositions they're offering, the premises, and drilling down. Peikoff calls it reducing down to those fundamental facts that we know, the basic things of reality that we've integrated since a very early age, so that we can determine whether this is a floating abstraction or not, you know?
Yeah. And do you believe that, it's clear that this stuff was understood thousands of years ago, and it seems like there was an attempt to revive it specifically in the 18th century, but then some of the ideas that were spread in the 19th century, which I talked about on my show recently, seem to give what, if it had not been for objectivism, could have been a final dismissal of all of this stuff, all of Aristotelian formal logic thrown out. And
sure,
we have this world where this fiction and these collectives and these concepts that do not grow out of real things becomes the reality for people, which is, I think, so prevalent today with nationalism, the state, those kinds of ideas are examples of that.
Yeah. We live in a world that's quite out of context from what we really need to live in. And you're right that Rand kind of picked up where Aristotle left off. And Peikoff notes that Aristotle had his own set of contradictions about the essences, the fundamental aspects of concepts. And this kind of played into the hands of, you know, Plato and Immanuel Kant and so forth, that are talking about this intrinsic truth, you know, that we really can't know the fundamental reality as it is because, you know, it's tainted by the senses or something. That, and it leads into the supernaturalism too, that knowledge is somehow revealed to us through intuition or through feelings or just this passive reception of something. You know, people talk about this a lot with that support the beliefs in religious stuff. It came to me. I had a vision or something, you know,
now,
rather than using a process of reason to determine what is true and what is false.
Now, at the risk of derailing our whole discussion here with
sure,
this next question, could that
we can lay multiple rails of track here.
Exactly. Could that be possibly a misunderstanding of the power of the subconscious? How, you know, our conscious
yes,
mind takes in all this information so fast and is able to process it effectively to use to make concepts, to make memories, but it all goes in, and then people have these feelings or these hints of things, and they call that intuition, and some people say it comes to them from somewhere else. There was a book I read that I would recommend, and I can't think of the author right now, but it was very interesting. It was called The Power of the Subconscious Mind. And it talks about what people think is prayer is really kind of a form of self-talk. We're feeding mm-hmm. ideas to the subconscious, but the subconscious also slowly, and in some ways that might be somewhat unpredictable, feeds ideas back to the consciousness. And people say things like, who don't understand the power of the subconscious, might say things like, it came to me in a vision. Or
yes,
it was a bush. It was on fire. It started talking. There's probably a couple other things going on with that
revelation, right?
Yeah, sure. It's probably the subconscious feeding something back to the conscious mind.
Yeah, and then the question arises as to why the person isn't making that determination. Why aren't they reflecting sort of critically on their own thinking process and challenging their own premises, if you will? Because I think that's a critical, essential component of using logic, is trying to falsify your own beliefs. That's part of objectivity, right? Taking into account all of the available knowledge that we have, reducing the concepts, the assertions that people have down to facts. And if they can't be reduced to facts, then there's no reason to believe them, right? So the process of logic, you know, I mean, throughout history, people have seen it as this cold, calculating, dead hand of reason kind of thing. But it actually enables you to live a life that's aligned with reality, which is part of the virtue of honesty, right? Being aligned with the truth, with honesty, as you see it in your own mind, as you see it in your relationships and so forth. Being aligned with reality is part of this process of reasoning on the planet Earth, you know, to sustain ourselves. Because, you know, Peikoff mentions a couple examples and relates it to a quote by Ayn Rand about how people spend all this time trying to figure out what's going to make them healthy physically, right? So they don't ingest poison. They don't take in rat poison as a means to sustain themselves. They avoid the poisonous stuff to the degree that they have knowledge of whether or not it's poisonous, right? So that kind of lends support for the idea that we should use a reasoning process at any point in time to see if we're actually on the right track. But for the mind, it seems like people are willing and do integrate a whole litany of things that have nothing to do with alignment with reality. In other words, that are contradictory, that are opposed to the facts, and therefore to their lives and well-being on a planet that functions according to natural laws that we've identified.
Yeah. And from no understanding or no relationship with logic at all, from a very early period in our lives, it seems like a lot of these ideas have the resonance that they do because they're fed to us. Even the things that people claim to love, you know, like God and country, seem to have been inculcated through fear. So we're dealing entirely in the realm of emotion and nothing else. And I think Stefan Molyneux has done a lot of work on, you know, the natural, logical and empirical abilities of a child who will not accept empty boxes for Christmas presents.
Yes. But they're invisible apples, as Steph calls them.
Sure. Exactly. But when you bring, somebody into that emotional realm that is, I think, at a young age, and certainly it's very effective with adults too, as we've seen in the last decade and certainly beyond that, fear is extremely powerful and will invite people to dismiss logic entirely.
You know, the fear of losing connections with people that are close to us, for instance, if they disapprove of the line of reasoning that we go on, you know? And so that's why one of my favorite lines from Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, is by John Galt, redeem your mind from the hawk shops of authority, right? And accept the fact that a truth is, you know, more important for you and your life and well-being than anything else, because that's the way that you navigate through reality in a beneficial way, right? And if you accept 10 truths by other people on faith, that is much less useful than adopting finding out that you've accepted a falsehood on your own, because to accept things on faith without critical analysis is kind of a recipe for disaster. And it's actually led us into the low level of civilization that we live in now, societally, you know, culturally and so forth, where there's a whole host of contradictions that people spew forth every day that are actually hindering their ability to flourish on this planet, hindering progress and innovation for human beings, hindering, you know, just an amazing life that could be lived if people are aligned with reality, which is, again, ferreting out those contradictions. There's a section here talking about logic. If logic is to be the means of objectivity, a logical conclusion must be derived from reality. It must be warranted by antecedent knowledge, right? So it's contextual. It has to relate to prior knowledge. It can't be just arbitrary. Mm. Which itself may rest on earlier knowledge, and so on back, until one reaches the self-evident, the data of sense. So reason is the process by which we identify and integrate the material of our senses and percepts. This kind of chain, and nothing less, is what objectivism requires as, quote, proof of an idea. Proof is the process of establishing truth by reducing a proposition to axioms, i.e. ultimately to sensory evidence. Such reduction is the only means man or human has of discovering the relationship between non-axiomatic propositions and the facts of reality. So he goes into then talking about the fact that knowledge is contextual and hierarchical and so forth. And there's a really compelling statement here. How is a man to know whether he is contradicting himself at a given time? How is he to know whether some proposal or idea, which may sound plausible, is consistent with what he already accepts? Since consciousness is finite and limited, a crow epistemology, like we have a working memory of, what, 7 units, I guess, His mind cannot compare old contents and new in a flash of synoptic insight. It cannot hold in a single frame of awareness all of his relevant former ideas in the new item being considered. There is only one alternative. A man must work to integrate the new idea. Since the conceptual consciousness is an integrating mechanism, it demands the integration of all its contents. One step at a time, a man must relate a new item to his previous ideas. To the extent of his knowledge, he must search for aspects, presuppositions, implications, applications of the new idea that bear on his previous views in any field, and he must identify explicitly the logical relationship he discovers. If he finds a contradiction anywhere, he must eliminate it. He must eliminate it. Judging on the basis of the available evidence, he must either amend his former views or reject the new claim. And that's something we don't see a whole lot in our culture, is it?
No, it kind of, as you were reading that, I was thinking of this expression that I learned from a book that I was reading about getting things done called Getting Things Done. And
yes.
You're probably familiar with the book.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps using this expression that I believe comes, I want to say, from Buddhism, mind like water, right? So you can adapt to new things that come at you and incorporate them in a way that's ultimately productive or helpful or useful or educational.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the opposite of that, which I think is what you're describing of what we see so much today, is mind like brick wall. You know,
yes.
Idea like tennis ball, mind like brick wall. Kind of, yes.
Rand would call the concrete bound mentality or the anti-conceptual mentality. And this passage is really instructive in this regard. The opposite of the policy of integration is exemplified by the concrete bound mentality, to use Ayn Rand's term. This is the man who, as far as possible to a conceptual being, establishes no connections among his mental contents. To him, every issue is simply a new concrete, unrelated to what came before, to abstract principles, or to any context. On Monday, such a man may decide that taxes are too high. On Tuesday, that the government should provide more welfare services. On Wednesday, that inflation must be stopped, never thinking that these points are connected and that he is daily contradicting himself. More government services, for example, mean higher taxes and or inflation. This kind of man is ripe for any demagogic proposal, however absurd, because to him, the context that would reveal the absurdity is unreal. A somewhat better case is the man who does integrate his mental contents, but only within an arbitrarily delimited square or compartment. So now we get in the realm of compartmentalization, which is very prevalent in our culture.
Sure.
An economist, for instance, may eagerly relate a new economic idea to other ideas within his field, but refuse to consider its implications for related fields, such as politics, ethics, or history, or their implications for his own. That's not my concern, such a man characteristically says about anything but his own specialty. That's somebody else's domain. Ayn Rand calls this type of non-integration compartmentalization. This is an improper form of specialization. It consists not merely of specializing, but in regarding one's specialty as a dissociated fiefdom, unrelated to the rest of human knowledge. In fact, however, all knowledge is interconnected. To cut off a single field, any field, from the rest of cognition is to drop the vast context with which makes that field possible and which anchors it to reality. The ultimate result, as with any failure of integration, is floating abstractions and self-contradiction. A simple example is the conservative economists who scornfully dismiss philosophy, then advocate the profit motive in economics, and the Sermon on the Mount in church.
Exactly. We talked about this a little bit too, like a form of compartmentalization in the introduction to this series, where with respect to values, desires, and logic by the compartments of personal and political life, where, you know, all of the things that a person shows as abilities and exercises in their private life is thrown out in this political world. You know, the abilities that some people have, some people that I've met in my life, that I was very frightened and confused by some of their political ideas, were incredibly talented people in their professional and personal lives. You know, so I see that there's a real compartmentalization and division in that area for sure. I know what we're talking about is a little bit more specific, like within a discipline or within a certain ideology, like the ideologies we see in the country today, how you could be compartmentalized in one way when you look at certain things and say, yes, we should have small government. But then as soon as you go beyond the borders of the country, you say we should have fences here and empires. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think that's very prevalent.
Which is not relating one context of knowledge to another. You know,
sure.
It's like reality isn't viewed as a whole and the concepts aren't viewed as things that indicate aspects of reality, but rather, you know, there's two sort of competing camps in relation to or in contrast to objectivity. And that is intrinsicism, which leads to the religious stuff that where knowledge is revealed to you, and then subjectivism, where you create your own reality, that consciousness creates reality and arbitrarily determines things about reality rather than reality setting the standard by which we integrate it, you know?
The first one was mysticism. You cut a little there.
Oh, intrinsicism.
Intrinsicism. Okay.
Yes. So knowledge is intrinsic rather than objective, which basically means that, and this goes back to Aristotle and Plato and the early philosophers about how they saw the nature of concepts. Are concepts something that have like a life of their own? Like the idea of manness, you know, I think that was talked about by Aristotle, that there's concepts that exist in some realm. Plato talked about the forms.
Yes.
These ideal forms, rather than looking at it objectively and say, okay, the purpose of a human consciousness as it exists as a biological entity is to integrate things in reality in a non-contradictory way so that it can flourish. Right, because percepts are pretty much self-evident. They are things that we don't choose to integrate or not. They're just there. So when we use the process of reason, we're taking those percepts and we're integrating them into concepts to delineate things, distinguishing characteristics in reality, mental units, if you will, where we drop the measurements of them. The measurement omission is part of the conceptualization process because, you know, all dogs are not the exact same size and color and so forth, but they have that distinguishing characteristic or characteristics that make them dogs and not cats.
Right.
Right. So we drop the measurement. There can be a little, you know, tiny miniature poodle, or there can be a Great Dane. They're both in the concept of dog. And this is not an arbitrary process as the subjectivists contend. You know, there's a long line of those, and Peikoff lists those various philosophers that sort of undermine our ability to comprehend things objectively by saying that things are just subjective and arbitrary, that we can't know things for certain, that there are no absolute truths, these kind of bromides.
So does this get into the division between the rationalists and the empiricists? Because Plato is definitely, from what you're describing, a rationalist.
Yes.
Like it comes from somewhere within.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially.
The theory and practice dichotomy sort of thing. Like, well, that's good. And, you know, we hear this a lot in, you know, the political realm because somebody will say, well, communism is good in theory. It just never works in practice. But
Right. Actually,
if something that's purported as a theory does not accord with the facts of reality, in other words, that it can't be practiced correctly, then it's not a good theory. It's not a valid theory. It's not a true theory.
Right.
Right. So there shouldn't be this dichotomy between theory and practice. It should be integrated. And that's what objectivity does. It allows us to think rationally about things and again, reduce those concepts to things in reality, to facts that we know, and make sure that our thinking accords with what is real and what is helpful and true.
So as far as a basic understanding of this discipline, it seems like today we live in a world where we get a pretty good chance at learning this slowly. And I think that people look at the science of logic and they, depending on where they start or what they're exposed to or what they see in a college course, like you talked about your own experience in a college course, they might be overwhelmed. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure was addressed in this show is because unfortunately, we live in a time where people have just such little respect as far as opinion shapers or opinion manipulators are concerned. There's just such little respect for the intelligence of the average person. It's very, once you start looking for it, these logical errors, they're very, very easy to spot, you know, mm-hmm. And I was working with a kid, just a little off track here. I was working with a kid recently and he wanted to get into magic. He wanted to be a YouTube magician. So I helped him make a little YouTube channel for his magic. But we were watching this sort of behind the scenes, stuff of magic, and some things that would look so amazing and convincing. It was the one thing that you didn't see that made something so stupid and obvious seem like it was actually supernatural. And the thing would be like a toothpick. Uh-huh. You know? So you think about this in the realm of persuasion and rhetoric, like the debates. We looked at this Coney 2012 film, and we'd see it was just these little switches, these little misdirects would be all it would take to turn what should be very easy to expose as just empty, intellectually insulting nonsense into what appeared to be a very convincing presentation.
Yeah.
So I really just wanted to reiterate that people, especially young people who've probably never been introduced to any of these ideas in school, I don't want them to feel overwhelmed by what we're approaching or what I intend to approach in this series, because I think that the way you're describing it today is basic and helpful. And I just want to make sure that nobody feels overwhelmed. So
yeah, there won't be any sort of jargon that you'll find in philosophy class. That was the clarity that I found with Ayn Rand's work that I could not find with any of the other philosophers that I studied. And I minored in philosophy, and including, you know, Eastern philosophy and so forth, which is very paradoxical, you know, to the point of being contradictory. And there's this dissociation from self. So there's some problematic things about the psychology of that too, as well as, you know, Western philosophy in general. But this is not exactly an easy process either. You know, like we're in a big hole and now we got to figure out how to get out of it, you know, and just stop digging is the first thing, right?
Yes.
And, unfortunately there's all kinds of intellectuals in our culture that just keep on digging. So we get deeper and deeper and it's harder to see out. But if you just focus on the fundamentals, you know, the metaphysics and the epistemology, you know, what is the nature of reality? How do you know what you know? What is truth? What is falsehood? Can we determine it? Because there are a lot of people out there that say, we can't know anything really for certain. You know, that all knowledge is provisional. There's a whole bunch of people in the skeptics camp with, you know, the Michael Shermer and various skeptics groups. I belong to one in San Diego. And they take a stance in metaphysics that we really can't know anything for certain. All that we can do is perform more experiments, gather more evidence. And at any point in time, our world can be flipped upside down by new evidence. So it's not taking into account the fact that knowledge is hierarchical and contextual. And it doesn't matter at what point in our humanity we have knowledge or what level of knowledge. And right now, I think the total sum of human knowledge is doubling every year, probably. It used to be like every 7 years, but now it's got to be much more than that. How do we deal with all this new information and all this new knowledge? You know, we have to reduce it down to those essentials. We have to check those premises and make sure that we're starting off on the right foot, that the ideas that are being purported, these higher level concepts, if you will, you know, the abstractions from abstractions, we have to make sure that these are connected to the facts of reality. And when someone says, well, we can't know the facts of reality, well, then they're trying to arbitrarily basically cut us off at the knees. There's a useful quote here where, he's talking about the fallacy of stolen concept. And this is what we've said a few times already, that you can't know anything for certain. Well, are you certain of that? Because you have to use the concept certainty to assert a proposition that we can't know anything for certain. As we can't, there are no absolutes. Well, is that an absolute statement? Do you know that absolutely? You know, so, again, this is kind of wanting us to slip into that subjectivist view of epistemology rather than trying to be objective about things and connecting concepts to reality. So Peikoff wrote here, errors of this kind are widespread. The fallacy involved was identified for the first time by Ayn Rand. She called it the fallacy of stolen concept. This fallacy consists in using a higher level concept while denying or ignoring its hierarchical roots, i.e. one or more of the earlier concepts on which it logically depends. This is the intellectual equivalent of standing on the 40th floor of a skyscraper while dynamiting the first 39 stories.
Right.
The higher level concept, such as friendship, he was talking about the concept of friendship in the above examples, is termed stolen because the individual involved has no logical right to use it. He is an epistemological parasite. He seizes without understanding, a term created by other men who did observe the necessary hierarchical structure. The parallel to the parasite in matter who seizes wealth created by others is obvious. So you'll notice that in objectivism proper, they do use a lot of moral judgment and engage in a fallacy of their own, the ad hominem fallacy. Mm-hmm. To call someone that is really stepping outside of the bounds of logic and into the realm of just accusation and criticism, which can really derail your ability to think clearly about these things. And objectivism actually has fallen prey. Ayn Rand herself advocated a massive contradiction in the realm of political philosophy, saying that if we just call one group of individuals in a given geographical territory the word government, we call them government, and we have this concept that they have a legalized monopoly on coercion, that somehow is going to protect us. That's going to safeguard our rights. But that's, of course, not taking into the context that coercion is a violation of rights. And to perpetuate a monopoly in any economy, I don't care what services you're providing. It could be, you know, private security or military, right? If these are imposed on people against their will, and no one can compete for a better price and a better service, then that is a contradiction. So unfortunately, you know, there's an example of where her upbringing in Soviet Russia probably influenced her psychology to have this mistrust of letting go of the government meme, you know, the idea that some group of people should rule over others and be the final authority, right? This idea of authority. You know, as Larkin Rose has written a book about that, the most dangerous superstition,
yep.
This belief in so-called authority where we abandon our own critical thinking faculty and our own independence and surrender it to someone else who purports to know best what's for us, you know, and to act in our best interests or public interests. You know, there's a lot of the collectivism that's thrown in too. And Rand, you know, had an egregious contradiction that she promoted called national self-interest, you know.
Yeah.
Nations can't have self-interest. Objectivists talk about this. Like, we want to, once we buy into the idea of government, now we're in the realm of collectivism, right? Because we are not recognizing individuals as sovereign, but rather people within a certain country or a nation state. And they like to say that, well, this government would be voluntary, but that is not in accordance with the facts because by definition, government is a monopoly. You know,
right.
So there can't be competing jurisdictions. And Rand said that, well, if we had, you know, anarchy, there'd be just, you know, people fighting gang warfare in the streets and we couldn't get our need for safety met and individual rights couldn't be assured. So it's, you know, whenever you see something that doesn't make sense and you have a certain feeling about it, it's just important to look at the nature of the concepts that are being forwarded and chase them down to the nature of reality, the nature of human beings. That we're reasoning creatures and therefore we have needs for autonomy and respect and choice and justice and fairness and so forth. And those ought not get roughshod by various ideas that purport to somehow support those needs, you know?
Mm, sure. And ideas that are built, I would say, a lot of the times these more abstract ideas from a failure to go back and check the premises, to drill down to make sure that everything that you have at the foundation, you know, is ultimately axiomatic. And from there, you can just start, you know, if that doesn't exist, if you can get to these ideas that the objectivists did, but really conceptually, it's your, if you say nothing can be true and we don't have to worry about axioms, we don't have to worry about premises, conceptually, you can really be building bridges between clouds. You know what I mean? Like, there's no limit to where you can go. And I think we've seen, plenty of that, even just in the last couple centuries.
Yeah, we're in a definite philosophical milieu that is, you know, blatantly disregarding truth, blatantly disregarding the validity of the senses and the nature of objective thinking, you know, and logical thinking.
As people are presented with more of these ideas, I think that how it's important to understand how they go through a process, right, mm-hmm. of encountering something new and trying to distill it down to its premises. Is there something holding it up, or is it just dangling in the air? You know, so yes. how do you think people can do that most effectively?
Yeah, this kind of leads to this statement by Peikoff. He shows a little empathy for all of us, especially children, you know, about how to go about doing this in this culture. However you simplify the process, I regret to say the task will not be an easy one. In a proper world, i.e. one that uses logic, that is fully versed in these concepts we've been talking about, you would never have to engage in such a wholesale clarification of your knowledge. You would be performing the processes of reduction a step at a time as you were climbing the cognitive hierarchy on the shoulders of other people, right?
Mm-hmm.
You would be taught the method of thought gradually from childhood as you were developing. Then you would not have to face years of remedial work in order to undo years of conceptual chaos. Here again, as with the task of integration, you know, because there's two tasks, the integration and differentiation for cognition. You are the victims of a bad philosophy, which I shall soon name. And then he gets into talking about Rand's razor, which is about naming your premises. You know, so talking about those first principles to ask someone, you know, what philosophical viewpoint are you coming from? What is the nature of humans as you see it? What is our means of knowledge? You know, Rand stated succinctly that reason is our tool of survival, right? So if we reject reason, if we reject this methodology of using non-contradictory identification, then what are we left with other than, you know, the feelings, the revelations from prophets, things like this that can't be integrated conceptually or objectively? I would say, you know, start with the basic philosophical structure of the premises that are being asserted, you know, looking at, okay, what's the context by which this assertion? Maybe we could use a couple of specific examples and run through it.
Sure.
Okay, how about this one? Here's an example from the book. As an example, I will quote from a recent skeptic. And I think this might have come from, there's another great book called Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. And this is kind of the go-to guide for objective logic, objective epistemology. It's the toughest one to read out of all the texts that Rand produced, but it is that sort of foundation that we need in thinking for intellectuals to really grapple with all these arbitrary assertions in our culture and not be just kind of swept up in the cultural flow of things so that we can't actually counter the madness, right? So he's quoting from a recent skeptic who asks, how can I be sure that every time I believe something, such as that there are rocks, I am not deceived into so believing by a mad scientist who by means of electrodes implanted in my brain manipulates my beliefs? Unquote. According to this approach, we cannot be sure that there are rocks. Such a belief is regarded as a complex matter open to doubt and discussion. But what we can properly take as our starting point in considering the matter and explaining our doubt is there are scientists, there are electrodes, men have brains, scientists can go mad, electrodes can affect brain function. All of this, it seems, is self-evident information, which anyone can invoke whenever he feels like it. How is it possible to know such sophisticated facts, yet not know that there are rocks? The author, who is a professor of philosophy, feels no need to raise such a question. He feels free to begin philosophizing at random, treating advanced knowledge as a primary and using it to undercut the direct evidence of men's eyes. This individual does not merely use advanced knowledge while ignoring its roots. He uses the knowledge to destroy its own roots. And he does not merely misappropriate in this fashion a single term, but a complex body of conclusions. He is guilty not merely of one stolen concept, but of conceptual grand larceny. Isn't that interesting? And we've heard examples of this. How do I know what I know? You know, who's to say we're not in some mason jar, some experiment by some supernatural being? How do we know this is the real reality? Gets back to the Matrix, right? And, you know, you mentioned the Ayn Rand lexicon. You can direct folks to the Rand's Razor section and they can, you know, sort of grasp that concept that she articulated. It's kind of like the law of parsimony or Occam's Razor. You know, don't start creating things that don't need to be created.
So one of the examples that I'd like to try and to deal with is there's lots of situations for young people that they encounter where people present themselves as experts far and beyond what that young person's knowledge might be. And it puts them in a position where they don't feel equipped to even raise any questions about what they might be told. And I think that, that one place where this really happens is college, right? And I think I see a lot of people who have very, these minds of concrete, you know, are very attracted to that intellectual university professor, setting where they have all of these very, open, spongy young minds coming in from the public school. Who will kind of chase after them and worship them because they've written the textbook. So there's a sort of appeal for people who want that interpersonal, even though it's not really genuine, reinforcement for their belief system to be reflected back to them by these sycophantic students. But I think that would be one example. But I think we see this a lot in high school as well. And one of the things that I'm particularly concerned about that I've dealt with a lot on my show in the past is these kids who are being told that something is wrong with them and they're being given specifics, you know, and told that, you know, this is a real disorder and this is, this can be solved or handled through medication. And I think there's a lot of young people, and I've gotten emails from people about this, like, I didn't know what to do in the time, but I felt like it was wrong, and I couldn't, how could I argue with a person who purported themselves as knowing so much more about me than me? So, you know, part of this is, if we want to use a more practical example, part of this is really about self-defense as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. Yes. And that kind of leads into the psychology, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, Nathaniel Brandon, who taught objectivism for a good number of years and has like a 20-hour course on it still available from decades ago. But he devoted his career to self-esteem, and he called it the immune system of consciousness. Mm. So the belief, the conviction that your mind is competent to think and judge and cope with the facts of reality, the challenges of life and so forth, that conviction that you have self-confidence, and then the feeling that you're worthy of happiness, that, you know, happiness is your birthright, which is something that is, you know, it's stated in the, you know, the Bill of Rights or the Declaration of Independence, I guess, the pursuit of happiness, right? But right. There are many factors in our culture, religious and status, that undermine that fundamental feeling of being worthy of happiness, whether it's original sin and the guilt or, you know, if you disobey a law or some rule that you're talking about, like in the classroom, somehow you're defective. Right. You know, you should feel guilty for this, for asserting your need for autonomy, your need for understanding and meaning that's not getting met in this classroom. Yeah. So it's about taking into account that context that is deleterious, that's harmful to your own rational well-being, right? Yeah. Your own self-interest. And I think that's another key that gets into the ethics of philosophy. So that's the third branch, that the purpose of ethics is to guide us to flourish as self-interested beings that can achieve happiness and then relate to other people similarly that have also achieved that, you know? So a lot of the things that we're told to do or else, we have to do all these things that we don't want to do or we're going to get punished, those are completely contrary to our rational self-interest.
Right. So there's really an interplay here and an integration. There's no logical taekwondo that somebody can do in the moment to counter some of these things that are being thrown at them, and that there is an emotional component to this as well that's very important that people realize. And I think that also leads into the other thing that I wanted to talk about as far as communicating with other people is attitudes and values. Because your, like I said, your background knowledge can be terrific. Your logic can be flawless. Your rhetorical skills as far as your ability to engage and entertain people as you try to provide information could be advanced. But if your attitude is crap, it's really going to sabotage the overall, persuasion or the ability to have, productive dialogue with other people. So this is definitely something that you've done a lot of work on and discussed a lot on your show. And I know one of my co-hosts for the live show is also part of your NVC, what's it called, a Hangout on Google?
Hangout, yes, the weekly Hangouts on Google Plus,
So as far as persuasion is concerned, I think a good final piece here to integrate would be attitudes and values. Thoughts on that?
So values under objectivist ethics are those things that we act to gain and or keep, and the virtues are the means by which we go about doing that. And since I encountered psychologist Marshall Rosenberg's work on nonviolent communication, I think that his methodology is more useful in this realm. We can talk about explicit philosophy like we have been, but when we bring this topic to other people that aren't so knowledgeable about it, or who are contesting it, who are antagonistic to it, who are somehow seemingly defying or denying truths, you know, that are somewhat self-evident once we inspect the context and the hierarchy of knowledge issues and so forth that we've been discussing, then we are in the realm of emotion. We're in the realm of a person clutching to a belief system and getting defensive when it's sort of pried away from them through the philosophical logic, right? This logic can be used as a sword, and that can be dangerous, right? It can separate people in their ability to connect with each other and find some common ground and to resolve disagreements. You know, objectivists are pretty well known, almost infamous, for being judgmental.
Sure.
And they actually exercise excommunications in their group. Right. So there's lots of infighting and intergroup fighting among this this ideology. And that's terribly unfortunate. However, it is symptomatic of the larger culture that we tend to look at other people who disagree with us in a judgmental way, that there's something that they're doing that is immoral. And Rand, in this book, in this section, actually, I think it's maybe in the reason section, the root of all evil is evasion. According to Ayn Rand, right? To evade facts deliberately, willingly, wantingly to do that. And so once you're in that realm of thinking of good and evil, good, bad, and all that, it can be very easy in our culture where we're trained to think in terms of moral judgments to dismiss someone else and to criticize them and even engage in ad hominem rather than try to connect with where they are emotionally. Why is it so difficult for them to let go of this belief that is actually just a floating abstraction? It's not based on anything in reality. Right. They want it to be. They assert it maybe that it's going to be. And, you know, in the realm of statism and government and so forth, people point to all kinds of things as to why they should hold on to these beliefs. But at the end of the day, the reason why they're holding on to them, the reason why they're not being curious about someone else's discussion with a logical methodology is because they fear the consequences of going down that track, going down that route, because they're going to lose perhaps some connection needs. We all have these needs. They're universal. To try to get needs met is the goal that humans, you know, strive for. And the key is to find strategies that are life enriching rather than are very costly. So a lot of the people that are upholding ideas that are not in accordance with reality, have strategies that are really costly because they're sacrificing other needs, namely, like we've been discussing, the need for logical clarity, the need for a conceptual human to understand reality in a non-contradictory way so that they can clear the cobwebs of their thinking and see things for what they are and move on in a progressive fashion to more and more knowledge and more happiness, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think focusing on the emotional situation about if this person is feeling anxious or insecure or fearful, then guessing those feelings and wondering, you know, also guessing what needs are not getting met as they're feeling those feelings. Because that's the indicator that their value system is being challenged and maybe those values are not in accordance with their needs. And that's kind of what we need to strive for.
And I just think that this is such an important component that's often overlooked. And even though this is a series on logic and logical fallacies, you know, establishing that background knowledge, like really becoming learned on a subject and developing a very good understanding of logic and even polishing your rhetorical skills. I mean, for me, logic, I think people would agree, is about removing contradictions and establishing or identifying consistency, establishing consistency. So all of these skills that go into this communication, this interpersonal communication, and the effort to have constructive dialogue or to persuade other people, you can do all this work, but the question really just becomes, how much speed do you want to build up before you run into that brick wall if you don't deal with the very, very important emotional component of it? Because everything else can be, you know, you can understand all of these other aspects, but if you don't understand what you're going up against, it's going to be very, frustrating. And I think it can lead to stress and burnout, people giving up and unfortunately, sabotaging.
Cynicism.
Yeah. Cynicism and even sabotaging relationships that when you're not dealing with the political realm, really don't have some of the problems that show up when the discussion turns to that topic. And I think there has to be another way besides just saying, well, I'm going to disconnect myself from these people or I'm going to avoid these situations entirely. I think that if a person makes a real concerted effort to understand beliefs and motivations, or really not beliefs, but motivations in this case, they do have a chance at, you know, productivity and progress in that respect.
Yeah, the emotional realm is a big one. And in objectivism, emotions are seen as the evaluative aspect of consciousness. So there's cognition, which is identification and using logic as the method by which we identify things consistently. And then there's the other side, which is the evaluation. Is this serving my needs or not? Is this in service to my life and well-being or not? And this is where we can slip very easily into the religious domination sort of thinking of like good and bad, right and wrong, and start accusing people who aren't meeting our needs, for instance, of being defective or flawed or not worthy and bad, right? And when we set that up that in that communication process, as Rosenberg points out, we greatly diminish the chances that we're going to get our needs met, you know, our need for consistency, once again, met by this other person. So I think we all want other people to strive to get their need for consistency met as well. And in order to do that, we kind of have to build that bridge of empathy over to where they are and help them across the chasm. Because frankly, pretty much all children are scared shitless.
Yeah.
Because of the philosophy, the anti-philosophy that they're fed, you know, and the self-esteem debilitating practices against them, all the punishments, the rewards and punishment model. That's, you know, the Alfie Kohn book, Unconditional Parenting, really focuses in on that, this pop behaviorism that we have in our culture about how to get people to do things. Well, we punish them and reward them, carrots and sticks. This is not treating other people as volitional reasoning creatures, is it? It's not respecting them in a way that they ought to be respected as reasoning beings, you know? And if we're going to have a society where people are reasoning beings, it helps to not use strategies that treat them as if they're not.
Like pigeons and rats.
Pigeons, rats, monkeys, dogs. Yeah, the Skinnerian model, the Watson and Skinner behaviorism stuff is still firmly entrenched in family and in education and of course in law, right?
Yes.
Because law, the whole correction system, it's all about punishment, fines,
sure.
Putting you in a cage with bars on it as if you're not a human being capable of reasoning. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And it's, you know, it certainly is even more pervasive than that in government. If we look at, you know, the intricacies of the tax system, there's all kinds of punishments and rewards for behavior.
Sure.
Within the tax system, you know, there's ways to get rewarded. There's ways, obviously, you know, to get punished.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean,
like Wesley Snipes had, you know, I don't know if he's still in prison, but, yeah, if you don't, hand over a large chunk of your wealth to an organization of people who really have done nothing to, contract or take in that wealth in a voluntary fashion, then you get punished.
Sure.
Isn't this a strange thing? But of course, the rationalizations permeate our culture about paying your fair share. No, let's look at the concept fair in that. So whenever we see a claim like that, pay your fair share, what does that mean? What does fair mean in a context which doesn't involve voluntary trade? Once again, it's grand larceny of concepts, isn't it?
Sure. Absolutely.
It's stealing the concept of fairness in order to, you know, smuggle in a whole bunch of coercion.
Yeah, and I found, too, that there was a lot of discomfort with my request just in conversations that I've had with people I know. It happened a couple of times when I was hosting Free Talk Live. People don't always react well when you ask them to define things.
Yes.
I think that shows us something, too, right? Like, it's moving too fast to stop and say, or the mind is moving too fast towards getting back to the safe place where I feel like I'm right to stop and start defining words, because I might never get back to that cozy place if I do that. It's kind of, it's known. But yeah, and behaviorism is just so ubiquitous. It's almost like the fish in the water thing in our society. People don't even know what it is, because what else could there be?
Yes.
They
respond like they've been conditioned to it, right? Because, geez, how many people are doing what they really want to do in relation to taxes?
Sure.
You know, a certain segment of the population says, oh, I'll gladly pay my taxes. But will they gladly suffer the consequences, the punishment, if they don't?
Yeah.
You know? So as Mark Stevens from the No State Project says, what evidence is there that anyone wants what the government is providing, given that none of it is voluntary? It's not voluntarily funded, so there's not a shred of evidence that anyone wants it. So
right.
Until we have things voluntary, we reduce this down to the reasoning beings interacting with each other in a voluntary fashion through means of reason rather than clubs and faith and force, we're always going to be stuck in this paradigm of just kind of like reflexively reacting to the punishment model out of fear, because people feel a lot of fear because they don't want to go to jail. They don't want to be accosted by a so-called police officer that's you know, defending the nature of statism to the death. You know? So, yeah, really sobering stuff. There's another section in here about the nature of what, you know, modern intellectuals and philosophers talk about. It should now be clear why we began our study of objectivism by identifying its axioms, and why we have been proceeding one step at a time to more advanced conclusions. Ayn Rand lives up to the demands of her razor. Philosophy is hierarchical, and so therefore is objectivism. The opposite of Rand's razor was stated eloquently years ago by a follower of general semantics, capital G, capital S, whose name I have long forgotten. He said it to Miss Rand casually after some fruitless discussion, as though it were uncontroversial. Miss Rand had asked him where he started philosophically, and he replied, quote, "I start where the last generation left off," unquote. This is what no thinker can permit himself or herself to do. He cannot take over unanalyzed and unreduced the context of his predecessors, including all of their contradictions, non sequiturs, and dead ends. This is the policy that has made progress in the humanities impossible. It is why philosophy for centuries has become ever more confused and problem-laden. When thinkers base their theories not on the facts of reality, but on the unscrutinized conclusions of their predecessors, the result is a uniquely repellent kind of intellectual structure, not a hierarchy of knowledge, but of increasingly contorted and insolvable errors. This is where the advice offered by the philosopher in Atlas Shrugged, Hugh Axton, is eminently applicable. Check your premises. If you propose to enter the field of philosophy, check your premises. See what they depend on and what that depends on, all the way back to the base of the structure. If your reduction is accurate, you will find that the base is the axiom with which we began. Existence exists.
So when was that written?
Gosh, a couple decades ago, I think.
So what we've seen, though...
Rand wrote that the check your premises thing. That was published in 57, so
all right,
over half a century old.
So that's interesting that she talks about inheriting, just inheriting your starting point from the previous generation. Because
philosophizing in midstream, right?
Sure, but in the 50s, what else could you do? And then for whatever reason, it happened in the 60s with my parents' generation. It didn't obviously stick. We were just talking about this in a recent show, the baby boomers who fought for civil rights and protested the Vietnam War and then became, the most authoritarian generation since the 1850s in Georgia, probably. Mm-hmm. I hate to generalize like that. I'm just saying as far as what the consequences of the way they participated in the political system and voted and the kinds of people who have, become candidates and rulers in a political system which people in their generation dominated. But, the 1960s, I think, was one of the first times that I know of anyway where we had this major, revolution from one generation, to the next as far as beliefs and ideology was concerned. And certainly 1957 was a long time before the advent of the internet. Mm-hmm. And we see how young people today have gone to Wikipedia and other sources of online information and news and blogs and have been able to clearly develop in many ways about many issues a more sophisticated belief or understanding of something than their parents have, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's historically, if not new, extremely rare.
Yeah, it's just sort of breaking up the ice sheet, if you will, and allowing people to kind of float off in their independent fashion, you know, as opposed to this monolithic, you know, when we only had like one or two radio stations, couple television stations, and who is the anchor that said, and that's the way it is, or that's the news, right?
Cronkite said something
like that. Yeah, I think
like
it's Cronkite.
Yeah.
Yeah, so people were just spoon-fed from the top down, right? And in accordance with all the philosophizing and politics in midstream, there was not much root-striking to be had. But now you can enter a couple of search terms in Google and find a whole treasure trove of information that can really shed light on all the darkness that we have in our culture today. And it's going to challenge the status quo, right? So, you know, that's the sort of rebel inside of us, the teenage self that's wanting to find some semblance of sanity and consistency amidst a whole bunch of dogma and authoritarian demands and, you know, false suppositions. So I think logic can really enliven that spirit of youth and just cut through all the bullshit, right? Put on the bullshit detectors and go right to the core of it and find that foundation from which you can work with. And then, you know, you'll achieve all the things that you can achieve as a independent thinking person. And you can have a sense of pride of doing that because now you've started from the basis of knowledge and worked your way up, and it's much easier to see contradictions, you know, as opposed to floating up there in the clouds with the rest of the intellectuals and then trying to figure out in that cutoff context, you know, where the contradictions are. Well, they have to be kind of drawn back to reality. And if they don't, then we can dismiss them as arbitrary things. and not valid, invalid concepts.
And these kids, from my experience, you know, having been a teacher, having worked with teenagers, even after the impacts of culture and society and parenting and public schooling, their bullshit detectors are still, you know, pretty sharp a lot of the time. It's just the problem has been for so long, they had no reinforcements except each other, and they had to kind of really suffer in silence. And finally, we live in an age where they can come to places like what I'm hoping my website would be, some reinforcements, and say, no, even though I'm not giving real specific advice on what a person can do, but to say, no, it's not you that's defective, right? It's not, you're not the problem. And the way you feel is a very natural reaction to what's being imposed on you. So for that reason, despite some frustrations and backslides, I think that this is an exciting time.
Absolutely. Still. Yeah, we can only go up, I think, other than the economy could go down a little bit farther. But sure. Philosophically, I think we're on our way up and out because we have all the answers. We have all the solutions. We have methodology of logic, and we, you know, can confide in ourselves as thinking beings able to see things as they are in a non-contradictory way. And this helps us, you know, with anything in life and especially our own happiness. So yeah, that's a really uplifting thing to have that sort of sanctuary where people can go to know that they're not defective, that guilt is something that is, you know, a domination sort of feeling. That's what I really like about Marshall Rosenberg's work on nonviolent communication, because he really focuses on rational self-interest and not sacrificing for other people's demands. Keep negotiating, right? And seek out a society or a culture, a community where everyone can get their needs met without any sacrifices. You know, this is kind of an unheard of concept in modern culture and throughout history, for that matter, since the advent of civilization. There's always been people sacrificed for the common good or for some other person's version of what is good. And this, of course, starts in the family as well, where kids are told to do something or else. But we can still, later in life, pick up the pieces and make sense of things in a non-contradictory way, and then be zealous advocates for getting needs met.
In the upcoming installments of this series, we will begin to look at specific examples of logical fallacies, trying to group them together in a way that makes sense. If you have a specific example, something that you've stumbled across on YouTube, please do not hesitate to send it my way.